Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's June 11, 2012, and this is episode 339. And today I'm going to bring you an interview with Frederick Van Johnson of This Week in Photo and MediaBytes.com. And we recorded this as a Google Hangout, so the audio quality is not great, but it does give us the ability to actually give you something to look at as well. You can see us both chatting and interacting on the blog post at mbp.ac/339, where you'll find an embedded video. I'm going to split the audio, which is what you're listening to now, and I'll put the audio in as an enhanced podcast and an MP3 as usual. And I'm also going to embed Frederick's images at the time. So we will make it an enhanced podcast, but you'll be able to see them at much larger size at the blog post that I just mentioned. So do go over and take a look at that as we enjoy our chat with Frederick Van Johnson.
This is pretty cool. I mean, we've just gone live with a laugh. It's always good to start a hangout with a laugh.
That's perfect.
So, welcome, Frederick. This is going to be episode probably 339 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, and
339. That's you should get an award or something for that.
I wish. But yeah, so really, welcome to the show, Frederick. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you on my show for once.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Like I was saying I think I put it on Google Plus or something, I'm excited to have the tables turned. But I'm also a little apprehensive. I don't know how I'm going to react when I'm not controlling the situation.
Well, don't worry. I mean, I've got a very slight amount of nervousness at doing this, so I've just put together a whole load of trick questions to trip you up, and it's going to be tell us, who is Frederick Van Johnson and why?
Wow. Is that the first question? And why am I Frederick? Yeah,
exactly.
What is the nature of the universe and why, right? Great.
Let's get started. I quickly wanted to just say, you know, I can't imagine that there are any listeners of my own podcast that don't always also listen to TWIP. But Frederick is the host of This Week in Photo, and I've had the honor of being on that with you guys probably once a month or so for the last few months, and that's a lot of fun and very different to what I do. So it's been great to do that. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Frederick. I mean, let's start with a lot of photographers have these. I took my first photograph as an embryo and all of that. But I mean, it's like this race to who picked the camera up first and all of that. But
yeah, yeah.
You know, seriously, when did you shoot your first photograph?
I would say I shot my first substantive photograph when I was active duty in the military. So my photographic career didn't start like when I was a zygote or anything like that. it was a little bit later than that. I knew at an early age that I wanted to do something creative, and I was always going to we had these things called libraries back then that people would go to find out information. So I would always go to the library, and I was always in the nonfiction sort of how to make this, how to make a go-kart, how to make a bottle, you know, all this stuff. It was crazy. It was always a how-to thing that I had my brain around. And then at some point when I was growing up, I decided, hey, this computer stuff is interesting. I want to be a computer artist or a graphic artist. And I mistakenly thought, in order to do that, I have to learn programming. So I thought, okay, I have to be a programming, and that whole math thing, I'm going to have to do that. So I started learning programming and all that, and then I quickly determined, like, you know, this is too much effort just to execute something creative on the screen. So I sort of gave it up and decided, and this is a whole non sequitur, not many people know this, I gave up the all that stuff and decided I wanted to be a magician.
Brilliant.
I'm not kidding. I thought I was going to be a magician. I was going to be, like, this is before David Blaine. I was going to be David Blaine. This is back in the David Copperfield days when he was doing all those TV specials and making the Statue of Liberty disappear and all that. I was like, I want to be that. I'm going to be that guy, but I'm going to be the cool version of him.
Yeah. You know? And I'm sure you would have been.
I even went so far as to do children's parties and all that stuff. You know?
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. One day I will do a magic trick. I'll do a hangout magic show.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I should totally do that. So fast forward again. I went into the military and sort of figured out, you know, when I went into the military, I went in as an enlisted, not an officer. So I went in and they were basically, you know, when you go in as enlisted, they basically tell you what you're going to be. You know, they hand out your life at one day during basic training. You're like, okay, you're going to drive a tank. You are going to lay pavement. You're going to shoot stuff. And you're a photographer. And I was like, awesome. And then they tell you where you're going. And they're like, you're going to Ohio, and you're going to Minnesota, and Frederick, you're going to Japan.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I was 2 for 2. So yeah. That's where it struck me, because when you're in the military, you know, I was on what they call OJT, on-the-job training, and I had what they called back then, I think they still call them this, but it was the CDC, the career development courses, which was a stack about this, I'm not even kidding, it was about this tall. About that tall of just photography learning materials, like everything. They started from the basics, like the photon, literally. Like, this is light. You know, this is light. This is how fast light travels. This is what happens when light hits something. This is specular diffuse. They started from the beginning. It was months until I actually picked up a camera to capture the light that I'd been learning about. So they built the foundation all the way up through it. And then, you know, when I started shooting, I felt like a photographer, because it wasn't a matter of, hey, look at this camera. How do I figure out how it works? It was, this lets me control that stuff that they've been telling me about. you know?
Yeah.
So now I can control the amount of that stuff that hits the film.
Got you.
So that's how it happened, you know, and then I've been hooked ever since.
So do you think, I mean, obviously there's a lot of, we were talking in, I think it was when you invited me on to Trey's Variety Hour last week, we were talking about like the history of photography and we got into, you know, film and developing and stuff like that. So do you feel that learning, I mean, I know that when I hear you on Twip, even from before you invited me on there, I've always been impressed by your knowledge of, you know, you're always talking about, not always, you know, it's not like you go on and on about photons.
Always be rambling.
But you talk, when you talk about photography, you talk at it from a very scientific perspective. Is that from your training?
I think part of it is, honestly, but I think the other part is just me being really interested in that kind of thing. Mm. You know, I'm really interested in science and, as you know, astronomy and different things in the universe and how we, you know, how the planets form, all this stuff, you know, gets in my head. And of course, light is a big part of it, because light is coming from our star, the sun, you know, you know, all that stuff is in my brain of how all that stuff fundamentally works together. We as photographers, you know, our goal is to record that. That's what photography means. Photographer, recorder of photons or of light.
Yeah.
You know, I think and that's why I preach it all the time, right? At a fundamental level, you give yourself a huge sort of advantage over people that are putting the camera on auto if you back up from that and understand what light's doing, you know, and why it's doing certain things and how you can manipulate it. Because there's certain things you can manipulate in photography to do really cool stuff, you know, even if you were shooting film. You can do some really cool stuff if you understand the principles of, like, how fast light travels and when it's going to reach that film plane, therefore you can do some special effects type stuff, you know? Yeah. So, but if you don't grasp that at the fundamental level, then you're a slave to A on your camera, you know, or the automatic modes on your camera. I'm just saying, reach beyond that and make your camera a slave to you. And so that when you start hitting those boundaries of what your camera can and can't do, then you go to the credit card and buy a better camera that can help you get what you're looking for. But don't you know, use the credit card and Canon and Nikon coming out with new gear as an excuse to, hey, you know, if I buy that D800 or that 5D Mark III, it's going to make me a better photographer because, and then not knowing what it's doing. You don't know, okay, now it's capturing light in a different way, but why, you know?
Yeah.
So just be a craftsman and understand, it's like anything else. If you're a race car driver, it behooves you to understand how engines work and why, you know, and what torque is and traction and G-force and all that stuff. You want to understand that so you can be a better driver. If you don't understand that, you understand, okay, when I do this, the car goes left, you know, then you're kind of a slave to the car instead of the car being a slave to you. I'm just saying, you know, photographers enslave your cameras, you know, it's worth it.
Yeah, got you. Great stuff. So you touched on there. We've got a few listeners' questions that I have been soliciting for the last 24 hours or so, trying to get a few in. And I wanted to. We've got a few people watching live. And so what I wanted to just mention is that if you want to ask questions of Frederick or Frederick and I, then just drop them into the comment, and we'll check those a little later. But before we do that, I've got a few more questions for Frederick. So you joined the military, you found yourself with a camera instead of a gun, or probably as well as a gun.
Both. Yeah, we carry both. Yeah.
You were saying the other day, so you end up having to carry a lot more than a regular sort of soldier or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, people think, oh, you're a photographer, so you have it easy. You just carry your camera around and you take pictures of the other guys that are doing the real... No, that's not the case. The case is a military photographer is, you're first and foremost, you're responsible for your safety and the safety of the people around you. So you carry your, and the mission, of course, right? So you carry your weapon. In my case, we carried an M16 and a 45, you know. So we carried that and all the accoutrements that went with that, you know, ammo and all that stuff. So, and then you layer on that your camera gear, which is your submission, of course, is to take photos. You know, if it's safe to take photos, you take photos. But if you're deployed somewhere, you can't just take one camera, right? So you have to be prepared for any eventuality, and you have to have backups, and you have to have batteries, and you have to have film, which we had back then, and you have to have the right film for the right situation. It wasn't like you could just change a dial and change your ISO.
Right.
You had to, like, okay, if it gets dark, I need this film. I need this. And okay, I need slide film because they may be projecting this. So, you know, you have all this film, your M16, your 9mm, your survival gear. If you're doing an exercise where there may be a chemical attack or a simulated chemical attack, you've got your chemical war gear, your chemical gear with you, so you put your gas... It goes on and on. So you're a pack mule and you have all this stuff. And that was the still photographers. You layer on top of that the videographers.
Oh, yeah. it wasn't this big then, right?
No, they had these big CNN looking cameras with batteries and redundant batteries and lights. And yeah, it wasn't a good scene. It was a lot of work to get an image.
I can imagine, yeah. So you ended up in Japan. That you were here for like what, 3-4 years?
2 years.
2 years.
Yep.
And that was down in Yokohama, yeah?
That was Yokota, so Tokyo.
Oh, okay. So how was that? You know, it's like I always like talking with people that have actually been to Japan and experienced this place. How did you find Japan and all of that?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it was it was interesting. So I'm a Midwestern boy, right? So I'm out of Chicago initially. That's where I was coming from. So I'm from the Midwest, which, you know, was boring, you know, in a lot of ways. And I'd never been to a foreign country. I think as a little kid, my dad may have taken us to Canada once to see the Niagara Falls, right? Mm. So that was my experience with being in a foreign country. So fast forward to that, you know, I get to Narita International Airport in Tokyo, and I land there, and the first thing I noticed was, wow, everybody looks similar, and I don't look like anybody. Everybody has black hair, and they're about 5-something, and I'm 6'2", and I'm a black guy. You know, I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Oh, wow.
So I felt different. I looked different. I couldn't speak to anybody. I couldn't write anything, you know, so I just felt like an idiot. You know, like, oh, where am I? Can you help me?
Yeah. So without,
that's how I felt when I first got there.
I can imagine. Yeah. Without giving away too many secrets, roughly when, what time, you know, what year roughly were you here?
Oh, no, that's not a secret. I arrived in Japan in 89. I left in 91.
Okay, so you left as I reached the tarmac. I arrived in 91.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, okay. So
that's
back
actually
then,
the reason why I left, Martin, because I heard you talking. So. Yeah. Japanese people were saying that you're such a party animal that you know.
Yeah, I was in Fukushima for the first 4 years or so, and when we wanted to really party, we used to just jump onto the bullet train and come down to Tokyo and go to Roppongi, where all of the
and spend all your money because everything is way too expensive.
Yeah.
Remember, I was in a military salary, so a lot of that stuff was out of reach for me. You know, Roppongi was like, hey, if I save up for 3 months, I might be able to go over there and buy a drink.
Yeah,
not a good scene.
So we used to come down here probably once every few months, but then when I moved, I went home in 97, came back in 2000, and then I was in Tokyo, and I've actually been to Roppongi less since I lived in Tokyo than I did when I lived in Fukushima. I kind of grew out of the place, but.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
So when you left the military, you've had a couple of, I know that you've worked at a couple of big, very big, IT-related companies. So how did that come about? How did you end up in like the big A's?
Yeah, that's interesting. So the big A's, of course, you're referring to Apple and Adobe, right?
Yeah.
So Apple, I was at Apple first, and that came about. That was interesting. So before I was at Apple, I was at Yahoo. So back when Yahoo, I think I was part of Yahoo's first big layoffs. So they had... This is right when Yahoo was like, you know what, okay, we might need to start laying people up. So they laid off, I think it was like 500 people or more at once, and it was the first time that they'd done that, and I got caught, swept up in that little storm. And I was like, oh, geez, what's going on here, you know? So, you know, just like the thousands and thousands of people that get laid off in Silicon Valley all the time, I went home and freshened up my resume and polished up my contacts and sent it to a bunch of people. And then I think I went on a road trip or something, you know, one of those soul searching road trips. And before I left, I had sent out my resume. And when I got back, this was back when, you know, most people still had answering machines. Right? So when I got back, I had a message from Apple on my answering machine. They're like, hey, would you be interested in coming in? And, you know, it was ironic because the proximity of Yahoo to my house in Silicon Valley, Apple was about half the distance away from, you know, compared to where Yahoo was. So it was a shorter commute. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. I think I'd be interested in coming in to talk to you.
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. Let me check my calendar. Yeah. So, of course, I went in, and I think literally about 13 interviews later, they made an offer, and boom, I was there. So I went in there. The job I took initially, what I was doing was iPhoto. So I was handling the books and prints business for iPhoto, which is, I think it's become Apple's print services division. Okay. Yeah. Which is powering like iPrints and Aperture. You know, when you print out of Aperture, you print out an iPhoto and you get your greeting cards and all that stuff. Mm. It's handled through a service called Apple Print Services. So I was running that, and I helped set that up and build it and get the vendors in place and all that stuff.
So they were obviously they were basing how they positioned you in the company on your photographic past. You got the all of your photography. Experience that was probably behind that. How did that help you as you progressed? Because then you moved, obviously. Did you go straight from Apple to Adobe?
No, I had a pit stop in between. It's a funny story. So I left Apple and took a job. I got recruited for a VP position, a senior vice president of marketing position, down at this company in Los Angeles to build, and remember, this is pre-iPhone, right? So they were trying to build essentially what was going to be an iPhone, but then the iPhone came out. Now that, you know, long story short, the company's gone, completely gone.
Yeah.
So Apple obliterated, which was kind of ironic because I left Apple to join them. But yeah, so I left Apple, joined them, and then I came back and joined Adobe to be the senior marketing guy for the professional photography segment and Lightroom. So I got to handle all that stuff, which was really interesting. That was like interesting because that was a dream job of like, hey, I'm right. It was a dream job and a nightmare at the same time because it was a dream in the respect that you're working at Adobe. You know, come on, this is the center of the pixel pushing universe, right? It was a nightmare because I know a lot of photographers and I was at Adobe, so I became the point person for like, okay, fund my workshop and send me free software and all this. Yeah. That was my day. Became saying no or saying yes to people, you know, which was not fun.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking down here. We might need to ask this before we go on.
Yeah.
One of our friends on Google Plus, Zoran, and I'm not going to try and pronounce your amazingly cool second name, Zoran. what was the main focus of your photography in the military? Before we move on.
No pun intended, right, Zoran?
What was the main focus? Yeah.
The main focus. So it's a double-sided question. So if a military photographer in general, if it's peacetime, you're not at war, and you're stationed at a base, you're part of the base photographic unit, which means a military base is essentially a small city, in some cases a large city, right? So it's self-contained, it's got its own everything, including its own photographer. So what we did when there's nothing, you know, if we weren't deployed on doing war stuff, we did everything from investigative photography with the police department, we did sports photography for the newspaper, we did forensic photography for the base hospital, we did portraits, we did, you know, passports, we did anything that was photography related fell on us to do, which was great because I learned all these disciplines, you know, and there's a lot of the stuff, there's no room for error. Like if they say, hey, Frederick, you need to go to General so-and-so's office and be there at 2 o'clock because he's meeting this dignitary and they want a grip and grin shot with him. You cannot come back without an image. There is no, hey, can we reshoot that? So everything you do, there's zero margin for error or else there's punitive sort of punishment that can happen. Like, okay, I'm in trouble. Yeah. So, you know, which pushes you to become a better photographer. And mind you, we're shooting, in a lot of cases, we're shooting slide film, which is, how unforgiving.
Much less forgiving,
slide.
Yeah.
It's the most unforgiving medium you can shoot on. I think the latitude is like, plus or minus a third of a stop.
Yeah.
You know,
so you've got to nail the exposure with that.
You've
got to
nail the exposure on top of being focused and composed, right, and all that stuff. So there's no raw, like, okay, I'll pull out the shadow detail later. You know, you got to be right when you get it.
That's a good point. I mean, I was the same. I shot with Fujichrome Velvia or Provia for the 15 years or so before I went digital. Mm-hmm. No, 10 years or so. I often say to people, negatives, if you shoot negatives and you just take your rolls of film into the store to get them developed, they can actually, I think they automatically correct the exposure by 2 to 3 stops.
Yeah.
And so you get lulled into a false sense of security that you're nailing your exposure when really, if you want to learn how to expose, you shoot raw.
You shoot
with your slide film because that really does it helps you to nail it or learn how to nail it.
And that's what we learned on those. That was our MO for learning photography is throw a roll of slide film in there and go complete the assignment because that's going to be the true representation of what you shot. You know, there's no hey, I'll just everything was 2 stops underexposed. I'll fix it in the darkroom. There's none of that.
Right.
Oh, you can, in some degrees, you can push and pull slide film too.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's trade-offs like grain and all that stuff. But
So, okay, so now you're at Adobe and what happened next? I mean, I know that let's talk a little bit about, you were involved in the Lightroom project from when it first started, right?
Yeah. Well, no. I joined Adobe, I believe they were on Lightroom 2.
I joined,
and they were in the development cycle building Lightroom 3.
Oh, okay. Oh, it was later than I thought.
Yeah, yeah. No, the baby was out of the birth canal. I had nothing to do with the incepts of Lightroom. Just yeah. You know, but I do want to say that I was, you know, I didn't do it on my own, but I was part of the team that was instrumental in pounding Aperture into the ground. So, well, I'm going to go on record to say, you know, from a marketing standpoint, that's something to say for a company like Apple. You know, to on the photography side, to have done something like, you know, we built a superior product and launched it.
So I know that Scott Bourne has mentioned this week that he's ditching Lightroom if Apple don't give him an Aperture 4 with loads of new features. It's I do feel as though, I mean, like Scott gave me one of those little. As he does, little slap sort of get down boy things on Twip a few months ago, basically when he was talking about Aperture. And I prefer Lightroom, but part of that is because it's what I started with. I started using Lightroom from the beta, and I it's just so intuitive. And I remember seeing people using Aperture and thinking, oh, that looks pretty cool too. Mm-hmm. I later bought it because I needed it for writing my Craft and Vision book. But yeah. I now, because I'm so far along in how I understand Lightroom, it all seems totally counterintuitive in Aperture. But so I'm biased. But then, you know, like Scott was saying in that episode of Twip that Apple's had, Aperture's had the books, printing services, and all of that from way before. But I didn't want to get into an argument with Scott on Twip, so I let it go. But what I wanted to say was, yeah, but Lightroom has all of that now, and what has Aperture done to maintain that gap?
Yeah.
They had a lot of it first, but they kind of let it slip and allowed Lightroom to catch them up and surpass them.
You know what I say to that, and maybe this is me becoming older, when those kind of arguments to me are kind of like arguments about, like creationism versus the Big Bang, you know.
Right, right.
They're unwinnable. Those are unwinnable arguments, and no good can come of having an argument like that with someone.
Especially
not Scott. Yeah, don't have an argument with somebody with a big sledgehammer.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, in the end, it's who cares? You know, who cares what software you use? I'm looking at the wall behind you. That's what's important. When people are looking at those, if they're not a photographer, which presumably the people who you want to show those to generally aren't photographers. They're like just normal mortals, right?
Yeah.
Who cares what you use to post-process it? You know, it's a personal choice, just like religion or sexual orientation or the car you drive or whatever. Who cares what you choose to get from A to B? It's the work that is the important thing, you know.
Absolutely.
It's like the Nikon versus Canon. Oh, you shoot Nikon. You shoot the
Mac versus
Aperture,
Windows.
So you suck because you use Aperture. I use Lightroom. Or you're shooting a Nikon, so you're not a real photographer. Real photographers shoot Canon. Who cares? You know, it's not about any of that stuff. It's about the work. It's about the art. You know, I mean, we may joke back and forth about, hey, I'm a Nikon shooter, whatever. That's all in fun, and that's just ribbing, but when you get serious about it, it's not serious. Who cares if you're using a Macintosh or a Windows machine or what? It's all about what you do with the tools. And I think, you know, not to sound preachy, but I think that a lot of the people that start hiding behind the tools as, you know, either, hey, I need this tool, or you shoot with that tool, therefore you're inferior, it's a reflection on them as a photographer. Because, you know, most of I know a lot of photographers, and the photographers that are up there that are doing this work that you're like, oh my God, you know, those photographers, they don't care who shoots what, you know.
Right.
It's all about, hey, I'm trying to, I have this thing that's burning the back of my skull, this image in my head, I got to get it out somehow.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, it's the amateurs, and I'll go on record saying that it's mainly the amateurs that get into that debate about what you're using on the hardware side, both cameras, software, computer, and all that stuff. It doesn't matter.
I totally agree. And I think it's great that you say that. We had a conversation in the last Hangout that we did And it was after you had to leave because I scheduled it during the middle of the annular eclipse for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, and basically this is part of my point. There's that people are spending so much time basically defending their decisions. I think that's the biggest thing. The people, it's like you mentioned sexual orientation, and I'm going to throw something out here that probably I'll get some stick for. But I think that the people who attack gays more than anyone are the people that aren't quite as sure of their own sexuality.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, okay, that scares me. Why does it scare me? Because, I don't know, maybe there's
it's
something
like,
there.
Me thinks thou dost protest too much, right?
Right, right. So, yeah. And it's like with cameras, people say, oh yeah, 10 megapixels is fine, you don't need 20. And you don't. If you're happy, if you don't have a reason to go for a higher megapixel camera, then that's fine. But it's your decision, and you don't have to spend half of the time that you should be out making photographs trying to talk everyone else that's got a 20 megapixel, now a 36 megapixel camera, into selling it and going out and buying something 5 years old so that they can be the same. It's like, just live with your own decisions. Be happy with where you are. And if you really were happy with where you are in your photography, then you don't feel the need to defend that.
Exactly. And, and you're right. It's what's it called? It's called, I forget what the term is in psychology, but it's when you are, you don't feel confident in your own self. So you gotta outwardly project that
right.
Someone else should, you know, be something else. And I think,
right.
You know, with the photography stuff, if you flip it on its edge, you know, you flip it, reverse it 180 degrees, and you just like, instead of thinking, hey, I'm going to buy all this new gear, and then I'm going to go make some cool images.
Yeah.
You know, once I complete my, like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. Once I create my jigsaw puzzle, I get that final piece, that new speed light in there.
Mm.
Now I'm a photographer, you know.
Right.
If you flip it on its edge, and instead of buying all that stuff, go take a workshop or go look at some work on 500px or Pixoto or something, and look at the amazing photos up there, and like, okay, I want to do that photo, but I'm going to do it in a different way. So work backwards. So
yeah.
I'm going to do that photo. What do I need to do that photo? Okay. I need looks like it has really shallow depth of field, so I need a longer lens. Let me rent a long lens because I don't have that, and I need this and this. And work backwards. Build the shot and then shoot it, you know, instead of, like, building an army in case you need to go to war someday.
Yeah. So I love the gear. Don't get me wrong. I think every time I buy something new, I'm there. I'm mollycoddling it.
Yeah, we're geeks. It's part of being a photographer. Yeah.
But I totally agree with what you're saying. It's you buy the gear to realize the goals, and until you know what the goals are, you shouldn't run out and buy every bit of gear on the planet. It's it's really you start with what you have until you hit a wall that you cannot get over or break down with what you currently own, and then you start to consider the options. And like you say, you don't necessarily need to buy it, rent something. If that wall's only going to be in your way for a few weeks of the year, then renting's certainly something that you can consider as well. So
yeah,
it's all great.
We didn't have renting back in the day, right? I mean, you had to make do with what you had, or you know, and squeeze every bit of life out of that, and then maybe go buy something else when you hit the wall. But now we've got lensrentals.com and borrowlenses.com, you know, to rent stuff. We can rent exotic lenses and use them for a trip and do some crazy shots and then send it back, you know, be done with it. So, definitely, you know, if you're a photographer that's like, okay, I need the latest gear, rent something first before you buy.
Yeah. So you make some of the most amazing photographs. And what I want to do, we've talked through where you how you got to sort of relatively present day.
Yeah.
You've had a number of jobs at some of the big name IT related and photography related companies, and I'm sure you're the envy of most photographers on the planet. While you're doing all of that, you know, and you still have a full-time job, right?
Well, actually, no. So the evolution of Frederick, of where all that stuff sort of led me to, is so sort of moving a little bit away from corporate America and that structure and moving more towards doing my own thing with a company that I started called Media Bytes. So
you left, you don't have that, you are now Media Bytes.
I'm sitting in my office right now. Yes.
Got you. Okay. I thought that was, sorry about that. I thought that was still a side job. I didn't realize that you'd cut the cord.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I cut the umbilical and I'm doing that. So, and the whole reason for that, and to make a long story short, is there's a lot of reasons, but the main reason is, you know, I love photography and I love photographers. You know, this vertical, this community that we have is like, in my estimation, unlike any other community, especially with Google Plus now, because it's just, you know, opened up this portal into our community, right? Yeah. So I love all this stuff. But the other side of my brain loves marketing and the psychology behind marketing. I'm a geek about marketing as much as I am about astronomy and all that stuff. You know, just the psychology, a book that I was talking to Dane Sanders about, there's a book called The Psychology of Influence by Dr. Robert Cialdini. And it just goes into how you can influence people to get them to do what you want them to do, you know, for the good of them, you know, but it also goes, it deconstructs how people have used the same techniques that have been around forever to do nefarious things like David Koresh and, you know, people like that, yeah. You know, for all intents and purposes, brainwash people into doing their will. Mm-hmm. Marketers do similar things, but just with less potency, you know, So it's really that all that stuff is really interesting to me, you know, from the standpoint of marketing for clients, you know, with Media Bytes and all that stuff, but also from the standpoint of just watching the world around you and seeing how you're being marketed to. You know, like there's some stories in that book. I guarantee you, if you get that book and you read it, you're gonna feel like, oh my God, I can't believe the Girl Scouts were doing that to me all these years. Because, you know, like, what are the marketing techniques behind Girl Scout cookies? What are the marketing techniques behind Hare Krishnas? You know, all that stuff.
Wait a minute, Frederick. So you were in the Girl Scouts?
I was not in the Girl Scouts. I was a Boy Scout. I was a Cub Scout, a Weeblo, a Boy Scout, and then I was in junior ROTC in high school. And then I was in the Air Force, so yeah. I've been wearing a uniform for a while.
Wow. So, Media Bytes is, I mean, obviously that's at MediaBytes.com, yeah.
Yeah, Media Bytes, MediaBytes, MediaBytes.com.
So I've been keeping an eye on. I mean, not only from the content, but it's a great looking site as well. You've done a great job with that. I was gonna when we got onto that, I was gonna ask about your actual photography, because I know that you're a great photographer as well as all of the other great work that you've done in the industry. Okay. I wanted to look at some of your images and just and talk about them a little bit. Sure. So what I'm gonna do is I'm going to try to share. Let me see. Here we go. This is the button I want. So I love this shot. And for the sake of the people, well, actually, let's ask you to do this. For the sake of the listeners that are only listening to audio, tell us about this shot from like what it's of and you know, from the very start.
So we're looking at a shot of the moment after the candidates at the Air Force Academy or the cadets at the Air Force Academy became official Air Force officers. So before this moment of them throwing their hats in the air, they were just Air Force Academy cadets. After this moment, they were Air Force officers in the United States Air Force. Yeah. So, and they had gone through a grueling process to become an officer, you know, which I can't imagine. I didn't go through the process, but from what I hear, it's intensive, you know, to sort of test your mettle to make sure that you can command the armed forces of the United States of America. Mm. So this moment was they had done rehearsals before, so it wasn't like, you know, I positioned myself through some clairvoyance or something. So they had done rehearsals and we knew that, you know, that they were going to throw their hats in the air. We knew that it was going to be a really emotional moment. So I decided, there were three photographers there, I believe, and we all decided, okay, you cover that side, you cover this side, and I'm going to be on this corner over here. So I got on this corner, and we did know that the Thunderbirds, that's the Air Force Thunderbirds above flying over, we knew they were going to come over. But we weren't exactly sure exactly where, you know. So what I did was I knew the shot that I wanted. I kind of had it in my mind. So I had my fisheye lens on there. I positioned myself right next to the guys in the front, and I just waited, you know. And I knew that was the I knew they were going to do this. I knew that was the shot that I wanted. So I had my exposure. This was slide film, by the way.
Yeah.
Had my exposure ready. I was ready to go. And as soon as they said the word, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you the newest members of, you know, the United States Air Force, yada, yada, yada. You know, I had it on continuous high. I hit the button and just motor drived all the way through until that roll of film was gone. And this was the hero shout out, all that, because some of the shots had hats obscuring the plane. Some of the shots, you know, they're varying degrees of not coolness in most of the other shots. This was the hero shot. So
it is. I mean, I made it. I was going to ask, because, you know, obviously the fact that you've got the, what did you say they were, the Thunderbirds?
Yeah.
So, like you say, there's no hats over there. You've got the hats in the air. Obviously, you've got all of the dynamic movement of the new officers. You've got, it looks like it's raining hats. Obviously, a lot of those are going upwards, not downwards. But you've got a sky full of them. And then you've got the Thunderbirds there with the beautiful vapor trails, and then they're right in between four big hats. Yeah. So like the timing is perfect. So I wanted to ask if that was a one of a series of images. And
that was at least 30 images there that was varying degrees of those planes coming through. I mean, you could hear the planes coming, and you can imagine they went through pretty fast, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it was I knew they were coming. So it was, okay, here the planes, here they come. Hit it, you know, and just go through. It was just sheer luck that I got the shot. You know, it was luck, and you had to know how to expose it and compose it and do all that stuff. But the composition and the fact that there are no hats obscuring the planes and the expressions on the guys' faces, all that stuff was, you know, of course, there's no way you can plan for that. So,
right
time.
Exactly. That's also just going to say, you know, being there, knowing what's going to happen, being prepared is the biggest part. But then these little bits of icing on the cake, then, you know, I think that it's good to hear a photographer talk, you know, about luck, because there's always an element of luck in nailing something as perfect as this. But you're not going to get it if you're not even there, of course, or if you don't know how to compose the shot, all of that. That's all down to you. And I really, really like this shot. It's so dynamic and
amazing. I mean, it's like anything else. They say, you know, luck. I forget what the exact quote is, but it's, you know, you have to be there for one, and you have to know what you're doing in order to take advantage of the luck that's presented to you.
Yeah.
You know, if I was standing there and I didn't know how to take a photo, that would have, you know, that moment would have existed in my memory, which is fading anyway.
Exactly. Right?
Because the Air Force had trained me how to shoot, and I knew, you know, I knew kind of what I wanted, and we had rehearsals beforehand, I was ready to go, and I was excited. It was more pressure of, okay, I know what they're going to do. I'm gonna hate myself if I don't get a decent shot after all this preparation. You know?
Yeah. Wow. So let's move on. This is I've heard you speaking about this shot recently as well. I love this. Can you just, for the sake of this audience, can you talk a little bit about this shot of these beautiful young girls?
Yeah, absolutely. So this shot was serendipitous. Again, it's an example of, you know, I don't know if it's right place, right time, but it's keeping your eye open and watching your periphery when you're shooting. So I was actually shooting these two girls' mom. You know, I was doing a portrait session, like an executive sort of portrait session for her in a suit and all that stuff. And the girls didn't want to leave their mom's side. So their mom is literally right off to the girl's right there, you know, just off camera, and they were kind of holding on to her leg a little bit. And I looked down and I saw them, and, you know, I had a big softbox set up, and as you can see in the catch lights in their eyes, a softbox is set up and to the right, And yeah. I just turned and aimed down and shot him. And they were like looking at me like I was crazy for shooting.
well, that comes across in the eyes. But you've also got this cheeky look of the girl in the back there. And it's just it just all comes together so well.
It captures their personalities, too. Yeah, I love the shot because the girl in the front is she's a little bit older. I think she's a year older than the girl in the back. And their personalities are so distinct. The girl in the front is a little bit crazy, a little bit, say anything. Like, I think she'll grow up and be some sort of performer, right? Because she's just a nut. The girl in the back is really shy, introverted, and extremely smart. So she will likely run a company or the country or something like that in the future.
Well,
but it captures them because the girl in the back, she's the younger sister and she's, in a lot of ways behind the girl in the front.
Yeah. So when that happens, of course, you want to make sure that you've got the copyright registered for this one.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Especially if she wins the candidacy.
Yeah. Okay, so you know what? I hate to do this, but I think that there's most of the guys in the audience will want me to talk about this one as well. Tell us about this photo.
So this is Linda Lee. She goes, if you Google Linda Lee Vampy, V-A-M-P-Y, and look in the Google search or the image search, you will see hundreds of images of Linda. She is an awesome model. I found her on Model Mayhem. And, just a slight story about how we hooked up. So I have a little studio in my house. Yeah. And before I shoot models, I like to meet them, like at a Starbucks or something, just to make sure that they're insane. They're not insane, and they know that I'm not insane. And, especially because I'm shooting them in my house. I want to bring crazy people to my house, right? Mm-hmm. So I met her. She was great. She's just, she looks like this sexy sort of sultry vixen here. Mm. She's a nut. This girl is a nut. She's cracking jokes through the whole thing. She's awesome. But she's got the model stuff going on there. So this was a simple shot. Again, one light. This is one light positioned above her, directly above her on a boom arm. It's a giant softbox, and that's a seamless background. I don't even think I lit the seamless. Yeah, so it was one light for the whole shot with the seamless, and the seamless is acting as fill and filling in the light on the other side of her face. So it gives me that, and it's the soft light itself is positioned really close to her. So you see the soft shadows and nice wraparound on her.
Yeah.
And as far as retouching, just very minimal retouching in Lightroom. This image never saw Photoshop. It was all done in Lightroom, and all I did was remove some skin blemishes, I think, and enhance her eyes just a touch, just to make them pop out a little bit. Wow. In retrospect, I probably would have put a little more light on her eyes to bring them out a little bit more, but I was happy with the shot.
Yeah, I would have been too. It was an amazing shot. What size, and I don't want to get too much into the gear here, but what size softbox is it? Like 4 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet?
Yeah, I think this is it's not a gigantic one. I think it's a 4 foot softbox. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to look at it, but yeah, it's, if you can tell, it's about this big.
That looks about 4 foot.
Yeah, but, it's about 4 feet. It's about 4 feet wide. It's one of those. Yeah, I think it's about 4 feet. And in this light source in it was, God, what did I have? I may have been shooting this because at that time when I shot this, I was experimenting with my Nikon SB900. So there may be an SB900 in that softbox. I'm not sure.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. Okay, so let me get back, turn off the...
I'm surprised you're not asking about the Japanese looking image there.
I was looking down there. I'm kind of thinking of time, but you mean these?
That's an iPhone shot there. Yeah.
Okay.
That is we're not supposed to take photos of food as photographers. It's like verboten. But that's at this place in San Francisco called Tan Long. And it's if you're in San Francisco and you haven't been to Tan Long, you haven't had their I think it's Dungeness crab or Drunken crab with the garlic noodles.
Yeah,
you haven't lived. You have to go.
It looks good. So
next time you come, Martin, I'll take you there.
Oh, I'll hold you to that.
Yeah.
Which one did you mean? This No. Which one did you mean? The Japanese Evo?
Oh yeah, scroll up. The infrared one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, got it. Where is this?
That is not in Japan, actually. That is in a little Japanese garden here called Hakone Gardens here in San Jose, and it's a beautiful place. And this was taken with an infrared modified Canon 10D.
So I've got it. Yeah.
Getting new life out of my Canon 10D, and of course it's a one-way trip when you do an infrared modification like that. But now I can do shots like this without a filter, without long exposures, without any of that crazy stuff that normally goes on with IR.
Yeah.
And if you notice, Martin, I don't know if you notice in the background there in that image.
Yeah.
There's a ghost. The Grudge is in that house in the back.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not even kidding you, Martin. This was during the day when I bought my ticket. You had to pay like $2 or something to get in here.
Yeah.
When I bought my ticket, she was like, "Oh, you're lucky because there's no one else here. You have the run of the place." So I was running, and I did not see anybody in that house when I took the shot. I swear, there was nobody in that house when I took this. And I got back in Lightroom. I zoomed in. I'm like, "Oh no."
So when you zoom in, it is a person.
That's a person. Yeah. I'll send you a high res. You can see that's a person.
I trust you, but that's scary. I'm like, the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up now. I'm like,
there was nobody there. And I actually went in that house too. I went up there I did this shot because I wanted a reverse shot of the bridge, and I stood in that spot where she's standing. And not a good scene.
Well, very cool. So Hakone, that's the name of a place down near Mount Fuji. There's a lake. There's a lake there, so they've probably taken that from the Hakone.
So if you're in San Jose or in the Saratoga area, photographers that are watching this, definitely check out Hakone Gardens, because it's like a little slice of Japan, really. I mean, like a little slice, maybe feudal Japan, but it's it's a slice.
Well, they still have those kind of gardens here. It's the traditional Japanese teien, they call them. That's great. So we're coming up on an hour. What I want to do is quickly go through, and we had a number of listeners questions from Google+ that I wanted to talk about a little bit as well. Okay. And first one, let's go down a little bit here. We've got Michael McGimpsey asked, "I have a D90, which is crop sensor. At some point, I wish to upgrade, but don't have a bottomless pit of money. Is it worth jumping up to a full-frame sensor like, say, a D800, or am I better off spending less and getting the latest crop sensor camera?"
Tough question, because he didn't mention what kind of photography he's doing. My knee-jerk...
Hang on one moment, Frederick. Sorry, he did. I asked him what kind of... he followed up, and I did get a little bit of insight into that. He said... mainly family, a lot of family shots, including inside, in less than ideal light, and also photographing buildings and at interesting angles. And he also uses this as his video camera. So we do have a little bit of insight there.
Yeah, well, from that insight, I'm not hearing D800 screaming.
Right.
I'm hearing get a nice tripod and. Because then low light sensitivity won't matter. If you're shooting, if he was going out and he's like, "Okay, I'm shooting night games, basketball, and I'm trying to get good shots of that, and or something that required that low light sensitivity, or I'm doing weddings, I'm inside all the time, and I want," then I might lean towards him jumping over to a D800 or something with better low light sensitivity. But If he's doing architectural and inside and stuff like that, then I would suggest staying, either getting a cheaper camera or staying with what he has, and above all, making sure he has a really nice, heavy, sturdy tripod that way, and a cable release.
Yeah.
So then he'll be set with all that stuff. But yeah, unless he needs to, there's no compelling reason right now based on what I've, based on that, what I've heard on that question, for him to run out and plunk down at a D800.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so thanks for that one, Michael. Tracy Owen also has a question. We've got two questions from Tracy. One is, what is your favorite subject that you photographed and why?
My favorite subject that I've photographed, I'm always, you know, my favorite subject is the one that I have in front of me.
So, I'm with
that's a cop out, but you know, I don't know that I have a favorite. I have a favorite type of subject. You know, my favorite type of subject is people. You know, I like photographing people, models and that sort of thing, because they're, you know, not so much because, hey, Frederick just likes taking pictures of pretty girls. I like,
nothing to do with it, of course.
There's nothing to do with it at all. But of course, that notwithstanding, it's the idea, you know, it goes back to psychology of this stuff. You know, it's the idea of being able to draw out an image out of the person, because you don't just jump in a room and start taking pictures of somebody. You have to pull out the personality and the image that you want to get by talking to them and joking around with them and, you know, getting them into the pose and what's the art of posing without touching the person, you know, all that stuff. I love doing all that. And then, you know, in the end, when you're shooting people and you, like Martin, you know this, when you present them with a print, people generally are much more appreciative of a print than, say, a landscape. You know? If you present, say, the Golden Gate Bridge, like, hey, Golden Gate, look at the shot I did of you. You know, it doesn't care. But if I give a person, if I put a person in that scene and do a great model shoot with a model in front of the Golden Gate Bridge and I give her that shot, she's going to love it and cherish it forever. So yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Excellent. So Tracy also asked, this is perhaps another one of those a difficult thing to answer, but she also asked, how would you suggest someone start to get into photography if they think they've got an eye for it? And again, I asked Tracy about this because, you know, I wasn't sure what she was getting at there, but she went on to say she sees things around them. But basically, I mean, so far, all of her photography has been a webcam. It's like she's got a webcam. So she sees things around her, the play of light and shadows, color and depth, and would love to paint them, but she's not a good painter. So she asked us, basically, did you see things around you, before you started to photograph, or did you start, you know, did you start with family photos and progressed? So, I mean, she's obviously seeing things that she wants to depict in a photograph.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say for me, when I first started, when we were talking about the beginning and I was going through those CDCs and sort of learning about the basics of light and all that stuff, there was this point, it had to be like a six-month period where everything I looked at, I wouldn't look at the thing, I would look at the interplay of light and shadow. Mm. You know, so even driving down the street, I'm like, oh, that's specular. Oh, look at the shadows underneath that car. That's a hard shadow. That means there's a point light source. Oh, look, the sun's a point light source. Mm. Oh, look at the shadows on that person's face. It looks pleasing. Why is that? Oh, because there's a big softbox above them somehow, you know, that kind of thing. So my brain was looking at lighting, much like, you know, the listener there. Their brain is looking at different compositional things. Mm. To answer the question of how to get started and how to start capturing that stuff, of course, you need something to capture it with, right? Mm-hmm. But to practice before you start doing anything, I would just jump in with the cheapest thing that you can get, even if it's a cell phone camera or something like that, just to start playing around, you know, and start capturing stuff and framing it and looking at it and making mistakes and seeing what kind of things you want to shoot. Once you start feeling out what you want to shoot, then you can start putting down money to get a better system to capture that stuff with, but to start realizing and exercising your creative bone of, you know, hey, I'm a macro photographer and I just realized it, or I like shooting people because I like the interaction, or, you know, I'm not good with people, so I'm going to gravitate towards landscapes. All that's fine, but once you determine the direction you want to go in, that in a large way is going to inform what you need to buy next. You know, do you need a strobe? You need wide angle? Do you need, you know, telephoto or macro? All that kind of stuff. So I would, before you make any of those decisions, just start playing around and exercise that creative bone. Go out, shoot a lot with something really cheap and inexpensive, and then, you know, figure out where your passion lies and then execute accordingly.
Excellent answer, Frederick. Thanks. And thanks to Tracy for a couple of good questions there. So Chris Blank, he was in the hangout that we did last week. Chris is a great guy, great photographer.
Hey, Chris.
He's asking, we seem so tied up on the gear, we forget about vision. We've touched on a lot of this already, but he goes on, when you feel in a creative rut, what are some things that you do to stretch your wings creatively? Where do you find inspiration for new ideas, techniques, and new locations? About six questions in there.
I love it. Yeah, the internet is the best place. You know, it's both humbling and inspirational. So, if you go someplace like 500 Pics and put in a keyword or something, and just sort of sit back and look at all those images that are on there, you'll get amazing inspiration of what to do. So the short of it, it's not just 500 Pics. I mean, it could be Flickr, it could be Google image search, it could be Pixoto, wherever, as long as you look at other people's work to get inspired. You know, like they say there's nothing new under the sun, but, you know, maybe not, but there's new things that you haven't seen that you can execute on. So I would when you're in a creative rut, just expose yourself to new things. Go to the bookstore and sit in the magazine aisle and look through photography books, you know, and just look for things that you feel like you want to try to execute on that. Hey, you know, or look through Cosmo, you know, hey, look at these shots. These are just amazing shots. I'm going to do that, you know, and look at the shot, not from, okay, they're selling me something, but look at it from the standpoint of how did they do this shot? How many lights are they using? What's the composition? What kind of lens are they using, as you might be able to determine by the depth of field in the shot? And then go try to do it, you know, and you'll find that once you start executing, you'll start building tangents off of that. You're like, okay, here's that shot that I thought I was going to do, but doing it this way is much cooler, you know, and then you have different shots, but at least you have that spark and you're out of the rut.
Yeah. I've started, you mentioned 500px. I have the iPad, and one of my best ways to relax at the moment, and I only do this once or twice a week when I've got a few minutes. I generally tend to work too hard, and I'm always at the big PC. But sometimes I'll just sit there with the iPad, and if I don't have something to read or something, I'll just open the 500px app, and that displays your images in those really nice square thumbnails. And just flick through page after page. And if you log in, you can like and favorite them, so you can come back to them later. But it's just so humbling and great to just look through that. 500px is a great place. I totally agree.
I need 500px to do something so that I can get it on my Apple TV. I want their images cycling through instead of Flickr on my Apple TV. Yeah. Nothing against Flickr, but 500px. Come on, man. So I'm looking that way because that's where my Apple TV is. I want to be able to, like, you know, have this stuff just sort of cycling through so I can look at it when I have some downtime and get inspired or kick back with a cup of coffee. But you're right. It's just the quality of work up there is crazy. And I think a lot of the reason for the insane creativity and quality of work up there is that people don't generally, like with some other services, people just dump all their work up there, you know, it's a shotgun approach. You know, if I shoot all my images up there, one of them's going to stick and somebody will like one of them, you know, rather than going out, shooting a bunch of images, picking one and then finessing it to perfection and then presenting that to the crowd. And I think that's the metaphor behind 500px. So So definitely, it's a good inspirational place.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is going to be – thanks for that one, Chris. I don't know if the next question from Mark Cooper is going to really build on that, but he asks, following on from Chris's post above, how does Frederick go about setting a personal project to improve and develop creativity? Is there any – do you do personal projects as such to build on that?
Yeah. Not all the time, but I do, you know, relatively frequently do some personal projects. Like the Hakone Garden shot. That was a personal project. I just kind of went over there. And a lot of the things, I think we did a podcast a while back. A lot of the stuff around creativity and inspiration, it's when you say you're out driving. You know, say you're on your morning commute. You're going to work. And you see this location every single day, and you say, one day I'm gonna shoot that. You know, there's horse. Like I used to drive into Palo Alto all the time. I'd be driving into Palo Alto, and in the morning there'd be these horses on the side of the road, like right there, like please shoot me. But I'm in like bumper to bumper traffic, and I'm just like, you know, one day I'm not gonna be rushing to get to a meeting, and I'm gonna pull over and get them. and I never did, right? So it's those kind of instances where, you know, it's that feeling of regret, which is the worst, right? So my suggestion is, like, when you're just moving about your daily life, keep your eyes open. Mm. Look for stuff, whether it's macro or, you know, or micro or, you know, big, you know, just look for different things that might make a good shot. Keep your photographer hat on, or at least partially on, all the time while you're looking around. You'd be surprised, just in your normal circle of interaction, you know, you may think it's mundane, but, you know, you may, when you, once you start thinking like a photographer, you'll start seeing things all the time.
I've had exactly the same sort of thing last week. I was actually pretty much similar to what you were saying. I was walking to my accountant for a meeting. I go for a monthly meeting with my accountant, and there was this, it wasn't a great shot as such, but it was sort of something that caught my eye that I wanted to photograph. It was like it looked like a Harley. I don't think it was a Harley, but a beautiful big black bike outside of a Japanese restaurant that had got this, like a Japanese old, what do they call them? Ukiyo-e, like, you know, the pictures, the old style pictures. It was basically painted on the wall, and I thought that this retro Harley style bike with the old fashioned Japanese stuff really worked well together. But I was in a hurry, and I'd only got my S95 with me. But I thought, you know what? If I walk away from this, I'm never going to get it. I never get a chance to do it. But yeah. I was there, and like my wife was saying, yeah, they'll be there on the way back. And I said, I actually got 50 meters down the street, and I said, no, I'm going back. I ran back, and I thought, I don't mind if I'm late. And I only took like 5 or 6 frames, but on the way back, the bike was gone. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm glad we did that. And I mean, they're still sitting on my S95. I haven't even downloaded them to my computer yet. But it's you know, you've got to grab stuff while it's there, because you never know when it's going to be gone, or when you're not even going to be around to capture it again.
Which is true for a lot of things in life.
Absolutely, yeah, not just the photograph.
Yep.
So, got a funny comment here from Matt Vanisek, or Vanit. Sorry, I'm butchering your name, Matt. You mentioned earlier about, I know that you should never take photos of food, when I flicked onto the crab shot. He said, so Frederick, are you going to tell Nick Olsey that photographers aren't supposed to take pictures of food?
That's not what I meant. But yeah, Nicole, you should not be taking pictures. No. What he's referring to is Nicole Young has a book out, published with Peach Pit Press, on food photography from a professional iStock kind of, you know, shooter standpoint. Yeah. What I was talking about is when you're out and you're having food with somebody and you're like, oh, look at what I'm having. You snap a picture of it with your camera and you post it to Twitter, you know. Yeah. It's completely different than what Nicole was. I hope it was different, yeah.
Yeah. So Zoran also came back probably about when we were talking, asked about the, I think, yeah, Michael asked about the camera. Zoran comes back and just says a D7000 and good glass. Maybe he was talking about with Tracy as well, but I agree to it. But I think as well, like you were saying, Frederick, you don't necessarily need to go out and even buy a DSLR to begin with. If you've got a camera phone, develop your eye with that first and see what the next step is. And once you jump in, I think one of the best things about the digital photography and the DSLRs that we've got out there at the moment is that the Canon and Nikon, and of course there's a whole slew of other companies that are making great cameras, basically, they create these amazing new features for their higher-end cameras, but the next releases of all of the lower-end ones, like the Rebels or the XTs and the XT4i, what is it, the next one? And the same sort of thing with Nikon. They trickle down, so you can get some amazing technology for $500, $600 these days. And even the kit lenses are better optics than we had 10, 20 years ago, so just grab something, the cheapest thing that, it'll help you. It'll take you past the iPhone if you want to experiment with depth of field a little bit more, things like that. But people generally start cheap and don't commit too much to the all of the gear until you've really, you know that you've got problems, like we're saying, problems, you're up against a wall, you need a shallower depth of field, then you might want to consider better glass. to begin with, just something very cheap and a kit lens will give you at least a couple of years of really good practice and exposure to photography. So I think
it's like when you you want to cook something, you don't go to the grocery store and buy everything in the grocery store because, you know, I'm not sure what I might want to cook one day, so I'm going to stock up on everything. You know, you kind of have an idea in mind of what you want to cook, and then you go buy the things to make that, right? Same with this stuff on a different kind of scale.
Yeah. And so one last one that I wanted to read out. James Billing also said, you shouldn't buy everything, but definitely a 70-200 2.8, ha.
Yes, I have a 7200. Yeah, I have a 7200 2.8, and I love it. Although I think it might need to go back in for some calibration. But but again, same rules apply. If you're not shooting anything that needs a 7200, you know, what's the use of lugging that glass around? Right. If you're only shooting macro stuff, you know, the 7200 is just weight in your bag. But yeah, you're right. So my standard kit, Martin, that's in my bag that I, like, if I'm going out to shoot and I don't know what I'm going to be shooting, it's going to be, lately it's my D7000, but generally it'll be a D700, a SB900 strobe, a 14-24 2.8, 24-70 2.8, and a 7200 2.8, and that's my kit, and that goes with me. With that, I can cover, you know, and of course some compact flashcards. But with that, I can cover most situations. If I'm doing macro, then I'll bring a macro lens with me. But yeah, generally that's what's in my bag right now.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned compact flash. We'll wrap it up very soon. Earlier this week, I was doing a bit of spring cleaning, and I went through and I found an old 8 megabyte compact flash card from Canon. and I went through and I literally went through all of my boxes and things. And I was doing spring cleaning, getting rid of a load of stuff. But I found an 8, a 32, and then I went a 64, 128, 256. Yeah, megabytes. Wow. 256, 512, 1 gig, 2 gig, 4 gig, 8 gig, 16 gig. 64 gig and 128 gig, and I literally went through and I was trying to map the Moore's law to compact flash cards, and that says that, you know, things will like half in price and double the volume, you know, the size of the data it can hold every 2 years, and it works. It seems that with compact flash cards, the prices were probably still halving, and the volume, the size of the cards was doubling every 10 months. So he was a little bit, but it was, excuse me, it was weird to see. I literally lined them all up. I got a few gaps. I used to have a 16 megabyte card that came with my D30.
You kept all those. That's crazy. Wow.
Well, I sold the D30 to buy the 10D, I think it was. And I put the 16 megabyte card back in there. One of the reasons that I raised this is not just because I thought it was a fun exercise to do, but I found that in my 5D Mark III, a 1 gigabyte card formatted in that now, depending on the ISO, it varies slightly, but at ISO, I think it was 200 or 400, it gave me exactly 36 frames.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a roll of film. So this is maybe something that we, you know, like Chris or Mark, another answer for those guys, limit yourself in some way. And I know that people often talk about limiting yourself. Go out with just a 50 millimeter. That's a good one. I do that myself as well.
Yep.
But maybe go somewhere, but limit yourself. Take one card and promise to yourself you're not going to delete any. You've got literally one roll of film. And see what you can get on that. I mean,
that might be a photo walk idea. You know, do a little contest and just hand out one card to everyone.
Yeah.
This is it. You know, get it and get it in camera and actually have people. If you shoot JPEG, then it's, you're gonna get more than 36 on there. I was gonna say, because if you do JPEG, then there's no processing afterwards. You know.
Right.
Well,
yeah, that's processing. You could probably go to 128 megabyte card or something like that.
But
another thing, though, it slows you down literally, because the write speed was just incredibly slow. I wanted to just keep my finger on the button, because the 5D Mark III with a fast card will just keep pounding the buffer. You literally never hit the buffer. And I just kept my finger munched down on the shutter button for a while. And after a few frames, it stopped. And it literally took 30 seconds to write all of the frames to the card.
Wow.
So things are definitely moving on.
That's crazy. That reminds me of one of the first digital cameras that we received in the Air Force. It was a Kodak DCS 420. And I think I have a picture of it. I have a picture of it on my personal blog. And it was sub 1 megapixel. Did not have any CF. It was basically a Nikon N8008 with a hard drive from Kodak grafted onto the bottom of it. A spinning hard drive, which meant you got, you can imagine the battery power on that, right? Or the battery duration. So, and that's what we took out on some exercises. We took two of those out per photographer, and we were shooting with the low light performance was horrible, and the write speed was horrible. They died all the time, but they were a indication of where things were going.
Yeah, right?
Because it went from, hey, we don't have to wait for this slide film to get done and, processed and all that. We're shooting, and we'd go back to the tent, and we had Photoshop running on Macs in there. We'd, import it in and look, here's my image. I can send it to the Pentagon,
Right. I think that's let's start to wrap up now. But sure. one of the things that which one of your sites is it that has that picture of you when you were in the military? Is that the Frederick?
It is on, let me bring it up.
FrederickVan.com?
FrederickVan.com. And if you go to About Frederick.
It's in the
early days.
Yep.
I believe, yeah.
That I remember clicking through that a few weeks ago. You've got that incredibly cool picture of you when you were about 7 years old as well.
I know, I look like a zygote right there.
Here we go, look at that. You're just incredibly cute there. It's great looking through that. I thought this was, yes, I've just scrolled down. Like halfway down the page, you've got that picture of you with that camera that you were talking about. It's incredible.
Yep, that's a very DCS cool 420. Yeah, 1.5 megapixels it was, sorry. But the ISO range of 100 to 400.
And 400 was unusable.
Yeah, 400, completely unusable. It was like your face would be a pixel,
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, and now look at us. We have iPhones that could dance, the jig around that camera. And those, those cameras were, I think they were $19,500 each.
Wow.
Incredible. Each. Yeah. Look at us. Yeah,
well,
crazy.
Frederick, it's been a pleasure. We've mentioned frederickvan.com, and we've also got you're at mediabytes.com. B-Y-T-E-S, yeah?
Correct, yep.
So, you're on Google Plus here. We've got you're over at Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
Just Frederick Van. I'm Frederick Van everywhere. Twitter, okay. Facebook, everywhere.
You know what? One last question. Is Van
middle?
It's a middle name.
It's my middle name. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very.
Dane Sanders was asking me this yesterday, like why? And someone sent me an email asking me like why all the permutations of your name, Frederick. And the short story is, when I was growing up, everybody called me Fred, right? Yeah. It was just like, oh, Fred, whatever. In high school, I wanted to be cool, so I switched to Freddie.
Very cool.
Freddie in high school. And then when I get out of, when I, I wrote a book for Peach Pit and published it, and I use Fred Johnson on the name. I regret it, but I use Fred Johnson as the name. And then when the whole movement of, okay, SEO, you need to distinguish yourself online, all this stuff came up, I decided, hey, I'm just going to use my full given name, Frederick Van Johnson, and I'm going to brand myself as Frederick Van, because turns out there's not that many Frederick Vans running around Google.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's cool. I always wondered whether it was a double barrel second name or a middle name or whatever.
No, it's a middle name. And it turns out my dad's middle name is Van, by the way.
I see.
And I have two brothers, and we all share the same middle name, which makes it doubly confusing because people think it's our last name.
Oh, that's cool, though. Very cool.
Yeah, it binds us together.
Yep. It really has been a pleasure, Frederick. Thanks so much. We've ran over a little bit here, but we never set a time, so hopefully it's not eating too much into your private time.
No, it's all good.
But really, great stuff. It's been incredibly insightful talking with you today, and I look forward to chatting again. Probably, I think next week I'm scheduled to be with you on Twitter again, so
we'll
be talking again.
So the tables will be turned again. All
yeah,
right.
You can give me a hard time over on your show.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Martin. It's been a pleasure.
Me too. Thank you very much, Frederick.
You're welcome.
That was a lot of fun. So thanks again to Frederick for coming on the show and sharing all of his wisdom and knowledge with us. So, as I said just before we finished chatting there, I actually was on TWIP last week. So if you haven't checked that out yet, do so. It's a great program that they put together there. And it's at thisweekinphoto.com or just search in iTunes for This Week in Photo. But like I say, I don't imagine that there are many of you that don't already know about that excellent podcast. Note too that next week's podcast is going to be one day late. We'll be releasing it on June 19th and not 18th on the Monday. So that's so that I can bring you a review of a new product that is going to be released on the Tuesday and not Monday. So look forward to that, and I'll see you again then in 8 days' time. Thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+ and Twitter, etc. And links to everything that I'm into are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. Until next week, though, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.